this time, a new weekly constitutional, a book about the Constitution for kids that is not all rainbows and unicorns.
But I think the existence of the Senate and the fact that every state gets two senators regardless of the size of its population is the most troubling and troublesome fault line in the Constitution. And the projection is that this situation is going to get worse and worse. By 2040, 70% of the population will send only 30 senators to Congress.
That was Cynthia Levinson, who, along with her husband, Sanford Levinson, has written a book that's kind of critical about the Constitution, and it's for young people. It's your weekly constitutional. My name is Stuart Harris.
Welcome to your weekly constitutional, underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. Your host is Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Duncan School of Law of Lincoln Memorial University.
Sandy Levinson is a law professor from the University of Texas who's been on the show before in an episode entitled Our Imbecilic Constitution. You can Google it. Go to our podcast site and listen to it for yourself. But for the moment, I'll simply say that Sandy is a guy who thinks there are lots of things that are seriously wrong with our Constitution, a lot of things that we need to fix, and we talked about them that day. Subsequently, he got together with his wife, Cynthia Levinson, who was an author of books for young people primarily, and they decided to collaborate. They decided to write a book about the Constitution, which contains many of the criticisms that we've discussed before, but in a format that is for young people. This marks a first in the history of our radio show, our first husband and wife simultaneous interview, which we did via Skype.
I am Cynthia Levinson, and I write books, nonfiction books for young readers, and
I'm Sandy Levinson. I teach at the University of Texas. I've been at the law school now since 1980, and I'm also in the government department.
You're also in the what? The government department?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you're being very modest, both of you. I mean, Cynthia, you're a very accomplished author of many books. And Sandy, you've been a distinguished law professor of international renown for a number of years. In fact, we had a really interesting conversation, you and I, Sandy, about 7 years ago, didn't we?
Yep. The New York Times published an op-ed to which they gave the title, Our Imbecilic Constitution. I really didn't mind the title that much. And in 2019, I'd be ever more confident with that title. But for, I think, a day or two, it got the award for most trending article on the Times Online.
Well, I contributed to that because it caught my eye as well. And of course, that's a quote from, I believe, Federalist 15, Alexander Hamilton. And it did catch my eye, and that was the title of our episode. So if people want
right.
to hear...
I mean, in fairness, he was referring to the Articles of Confederation.
Right.
One of the things that we write about, and I certainly emphasize in some of the stuff I've done, is that what is most admirable about the founders, very much including Lin-Manuel Miranda's version of Hamilton, is their audacity in thinking fresh thoughts. And he was clearly willing to go after the Articles of Confederation very vigorously. And part of the theme of our book is to assess the U.S. Constitution with some of the same cold analytic rigor as they did the Articles of Confederation.
Yes, indeed. And I mentioned this for a couple of reasons. First of all, because if people want to listen to that episode, they can just Google us, Your Weekly Constitutional. They can go to our podcast hosting site. They can scroll down to the search bar and simply enter in the words, Our Imbecilic Constitution, or your name, Sandy Levinson. And that episode will come straight up. I love the graphic for it. I found this picture of a little boy on a beach, and he's scowling at the camera with his fist full of sand, and it says, imbecile, I crush you. It's a great picture, and it really sort of captured, I think, a lot of the tone of that. And we had a fairly high-level discussion there about many of the fundamental flaws, as you see them, in the Constitution, and I found it a very stimulating conversation and still quite relevant today, because that is, of course, as you've just alluded to, the subject of your current book with Cynthia, your wife and co-author. And so my first question is, you've already staked out these positions, and you've been preaching on the subject for at least the past 7 years. So why the need for this book?
Well, Sandy has, as you say, preached this position to grown-ups, lawyers, law students, the general public. I have an editor at Peachtree Publishers who asked us to translate Sandy's perspective into a book for young readers. We agreed, and this book, Fault Lines in the Constitution, The Framers, Their Fights, and the Flaws That Affect Us Today, the first edition came out in 2017. We just published the second edition. I can share the reasons for that, too, in a moment, to expand the audience.
Well, it's a very compelling book. And while I'm sure some people are listening and saying, a book for kids on the Constitution, boy, that's going to be a hard sell. They say the same thing about this radio show. And then they, oh, yes, I've had many people tell me how they heard promos for this show and they thought, I'll never listen to that. And then one famous occasion, a friend of mine said she was up to her elbows in washing dishes when the show came on, and otherwise she would have turned the channel. But after 5 minutes, she was hooked. And she's become a big supporter of the show. And I suspect that that would be the reaction many people would have to your book because you were kind enough to send me a copy. It's a delightful book. It's a picture book. It's full of graphics. And it is written, I believe, what, 6th to 8th graders?
Well, we say it's for kids 10 and up. Up being the older siblings of those kids, the aunts and uncles, the parents, even the grandparents. We believe we know of a junior college that has used the book. So we think it starts with 4th or 5th graders and just keeps on going.
Well, it's quite an accomplishment to be able to explain these very complicated constitutional issues, which we'll get to in just a moment, to be able to do that at a level that kids can understand. But not really surprising to me. I'm not sure. Are you familiar with a program called We the People?
Yes, we are.
It starts in middle school, and I have seen 6th graders teach me things about the Constitution that I had not realized before, or give me perspectives on the Constitution that I had not considered before, and some of them just knock your socks off. So I have seen kids of 10 and over really grasp these concepts, and I think that you've made a real contribution to that now. So that's a great reason for doing this. But I have to ask, was it hard collaborating? It's hard enough to be married. Was it hard to write a book together?
Well, in fact, our agent asked us if the marriage would survive our writing a book together. And in the acknowledgments, I thank many people, including our agent, and say to her that, yes, apparently it is possible to have both a book and a marriage.
Congratulations on that remarkable accomplishment as well.
We've got different skills to this. Sandy, of course, is the constitutional scholar. And as you say, he's been writing about this for many years and has thought about the issues very deeply as well as widely. I write for kids, and so I was able to work on, as I say, translating his ideas and his knowledge into kid speak.
Yeah, I would say, as a matter of just brute fact, that 90% of the book was written by Cynthia, who has justifiably won awards for writing books for kids or young adults, which I don't think I could do successfully if my life depended on it.
I think that's right.
Right. So Sandy, you're giving her 90% of the royalties, right?
Well,
shared bank account.
Okay, good.
Texas is a community property state.
Spoken like
it helps to have a sense of humor too when doing this. Although there were times when I wanted to tear either my or his hair out.
I understand completely, and perhaps more than you realize, I married a law school classmate. And we have frequently worked in the same place down the hall from each other, but most notably in the 90s when we actually had a law practice in Florida together. And we managed to make it through there without getting divorced, too. So I congratulate you again. All right, let's get to the book then. You have Fault Lines in the Constitution, some of the really basic issues, foundational issues with our Constitution that still trouble us today. What is the single most interesting one or the most important one to you, Cynthia?
Yeah, we probably do have different notions about that, Sandy and I. Writing this book, I came to the somewhat reluctant conclusion, despite the prominence of the problems of gerrymandering, as he calls it, gerrymandering, as I call it, and the Electoral College. And there's another issue that I think Sandy might point to. I came to the somewhat reluctant conclusion that I think the Senate The existence of the Senate and the fact that every state gets two senators regardless of the size of its population is the most troubling and troublesome fault line in the Constitution.
Well, tell me more. What's the problem with that?
It leads to so much mischief when small population states like Wyoming, North Dakota, Rhode Island, Delaware have the same representation in the Senate as, say, California and Texas and New York. Every chapter begins with a story. The second chapter is about the Senate and its inequities. And it begins with a story about Patriot Act funding after 9/11. But then it expands into ongoing problems. That one was somewhat resolved in that small population states got higher funding per capita than large population states. And those large population states were the ones with the greater likelihood of being targeted by foreign terrorism. But then goes on to talk about bigger problems such as agricultural funding. When Midwestern states can coalesce, when their senators can combine, say, 5 or 6 of those states, and 10 or 12 senators can agree on what they want supports to be for certain crops, such as corn, then they can hang up the Senate in regard to other issues that matter more and say, we want more funding to go to these crops. Sandy must have.
No, Sandy's absolutely right. Mm-hmm. And it is basically bipartisan. On things like farm policy, it doesn't matter that much whether you're talking about Democratic or Republican senators from the Dakotas or Iowa. And we write about that fairly extensively in the book. If we were writing from scratch today, we might talk more about policies on coal as the quintessential fossil fuel, that it turns out that most of the major coal-producing states are small states in population, Montana, West Virginia, Kentucky, Wyoming. Texas is also, surprisingly enough, a major coal state, but I had to learn that looking it up. That's just not a major part of Texas politics. We have 26 million people and so many other issues, but small states inevitably have only relatively few issues that their senators have to concentrate on. Coal is one of them, and that makes it more difficult than it would otherwise be to address global warming.
However, corn actually affects kids directly, because what we go on to in that chapter and talk about is the preponderance of corn in our diet and in the diet of feed animals as well, as a result of which there's so much corn produced that manufacturers have the incentive and need to find uses for it, including the development of corn syrup, which appears in many, many products that children consume, leading to widespread health problems for kids as well as for adults.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and we're speaking today with Cynthia and Sandy Levinson about their new book, Fault Lines in the Constitution. Stick around. It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. If you remember your high school civics course, if you had one, well, then you're kind of like me. You had to grow up before you realized that maybe our Constitution isn't perfect. But thanks to Cynthia and Sanford Levinson, kids today can see some of those imperfections and discuss them and discuss possible solutions. One major problem, according to the Levinsons, involves Congress. When you've got a legislature, half of our Congress, is organized on the basis of somewhat arbitrary geographical lines, state lines, and you give equal representation in the Senate, 2 senators apiece, to all of those states. And in fact, that's one of those provisions of the Constitution, correct me if I'm wrong, Sandy, where it says you can't amend that. So it was so important to the small states at the Constitutional Convention that now you got a situation where, as you point out, if I live in Wyoming, my vote for a senator is far more powerful than the vote of a Californian, you know, right down the road. And I have disproportionate power within half of the Congress. And then to extend it a bit further, the Senate has the sole power of governing itself. And so it can adopt rules which are not judicially reviewable, things like the filibuster, which allow even a single senator, but certainly a combination of senators, as you pointed out, to essentially obstruct the entire business of government until they get their way in what they consider key issues. And if I'm from South Dakota, that might be farm policy. And if I'm from West Virginia, that might be coal policy. And so you get a tiny minority of the country essentially dictating policies that might not be in the interest of the country as a whole.
That's exactly right. And the projection is that this situation is going to get worse and worse. It appears that by 2040, 70% of the population, because we are an urbanizing country, 70% of the population will send only 30 senators to Congress.
There'll be 70% will be concentrated in 15 states. So 15 times 2 is 30.
The minority of the population will get by far the majority of the members of the Senate.
Right. The 30% will get 70 senators.
Now, Sandy, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe this was one of James Madison's great disappointments at the Constitutional Convention, wasn't it? I mean, he wanted proportional representation in the Congress.
No, that's absolutely right. Madison referred to this aspect of the Senate as a, quote, lesser evil, unquote, in the Federalist. So what's the greater evil? The greater evil is that if the large states didn't acquiesce to the demands of Delaware and other small states, the small states would walk out and there would be no constitution. That is the identical argument made for compromises over slavery, that unless those compromises were acquiesced to by people who opposed slavery, there would have been no constitution. Now, nobody today would say, you know, because the framers made compromises on slavery, we ought to honor those compromises as a just, you know, indelible part of our system. But we do treat the Senate that way. We don't even bother to ask questions, basically, about the legitimacy of giving Vermont the same two senators as Texas. Politically, I'm sure that most Democrats by far prefer Pat Leahy and Bernie Sanders to Ted Cruz and John Cornyn, but it's only raw politics and nothing else that could possibly justify supporting Vermont having two senators, the same two senators as Texas.
Yeah, I think you're completely right in that regard, Sandy. I've actually seen internet memes by some of my more conservative friends who have, they'll have a map of the United States showing New York and California as outsized entities. And they will say, unless we keep the Senate and the Electoral College, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a minute, then New York and California would determine all of our national leadership and all of our major laws, to which someone might respond, well, so what? If that's where most of the people live, then they should get the most votes.
Since 1962, we've kind of pretended to be governed by the norm of one person, one vote.
What happened in 62?
1962, the Supreme Court issued a very, very important decision overruling earlier decisions that said that reapportionment within states was, the technical term is justiciable, that the courts could rule on it. And then in 1964, they invalidated basically the electoral systems of almost all of the states by adopting the one person, one vote rule. So I grew up in North Carolina in the 1950s. I grew up in a county that had about 30,000 people. It had the same one senator in the North Carolina Senate as Mecklenburg County, Charlotte, which then had 200,000 people. They got rid of that. They got rid of that in North Carolina. They got rid of Texas, so that state senates and houses, whatever their differences, that is, the Senate is almost always smaller than the House. Nonetheless, the principle of equal representation basically holds. That's not true uniquely at the national level.
So we've said, the Supreme Court has said at the state level, one person, one vote.
Right.
And it does that also apply to congressional districts?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it does.
Okay, so in the House of Representatives, I believe the current number is roughly 750,000 per district, okay? So we've got this idea, as you say, that, you know, it's one person, one vote, we're all equal, our votes count equally. And then completely inconsistently with that, we have the system of the Senate, where all votes are not equal.
Right, and they're grotesquely unequal. The U.S. Senate is the most disproportionate legislative body of any major country in the world. There are other countries that have somewhat similar systems. Australia, for example, the Australian Senate. Each of the six Australian states has 12 senators. And the largest disproportion is Tasmania and New South Wales. New South Wales is about 17 times the population of Tasmania. That is almost a pittance compared to the roughly 70 times that California has a greater population than Wyoming.
Given that we've had a Senate, that it is very firmly entrenched in the Constitution, and that people from less populous states see this as a do or die issue, well, is there any way you think that an amendment of the Constitution could ever be gotten through on this issue?
Certainly not in my lifetime. What will be interesting, with quotation marks around the word interesting, is what will happen in 2050 or 2060 when the disproportion gets greater and greater. And Cynthia's already mentioned the fact that even by 2040, which is almost around the corner, 30% of the population will have 70% of the Senate. And if, as I think is unfortunately the case, by 2040, the issue of climate change is going to be far more excruciating than it is even today, if it just is visible that we're not doing some of the things we really have to do because of the excessive power of smaller states, will there be serious political movements that are secessionist or otherwise really extra-constitutional? And I don't know. Asking me today, that is August 2019, what the most serious single fault line is, I would say today it is a combination of the fact that we have a completely unworkable impeachment clause that nobody can believe really works effectively without the ability to fire a president through either a vote of no confidence, which you find in parliamentary systems around the world, or, as you find in Wisconsin and California, the ability to have a recall election. One of the things that is distinctive of about our book is that there are a lot of comparisons. And there are comparisons not only with other countries around the world, but in some ways, more importantly, with state constitutions. Most Americans, frankly, are abysmally ignorant of even the fact that there are state constitutions, let alone the fact that they are remarkably interesting and very different in fundamental respects from the national constitution. In many ways, the U.S. Constitution is an outlier even within the United States.
Right. Then they might contain some pretty good ideas, some of these state constitutions. Cynthia, I'm curious, what is the story that you tell to illustrate the ineffectiveness of the impeachment clause?
Well, we have two new chapters in the second edition of the book, both dealing with the power of the presidency. That section is called, Can the President Really Do That? One of the chapters has to do with whom can the president pardon? And the other has to do with, but including, could the president pardon himself?
Well, sure he can. He said so, right?
He said so, but he wasn't the first president to say so. President Nixon also sort of broached that possibility.
Well, there's an illustrious comparison, but please go on.
And the other chapter is, whom can the president hire and fire and how? We approach impeachment in that chapter. Also, which is the other chapter where we bring it up?
The 25th Amendment.
Oh, yes.
That is a way by which one could fire a president by deciding that he or the future she is physically or mentally incapable.
I should inject here, we've done a couple of episodes on the 25th Amendment. One of them back in 2017 on the 50th anniversary of that amendment with one of the people who drafted it, actually. And then we did a subsequent episode called Duty to Warn over the controversy in the mental health profession over whether it's appropriate for some mental health professionals to suggest that the president should be removed. Ongoing debate within the mental health community about that. But both of them implicate the 25th Amendment, which, as you say, is a mechanism that, at least in theory, allows the removal of a president who is no longer able to serve. And it's your contention that neither the 25th Amendment nor the impeachment clause gives an adequate remedy for such a situation?
The 25th Amendment is basically unworkable unless you have a situation, as happened with Garfield or McKinley, that they're shot and then linger on for a while but are clearly incapable of serving, or if JFK had lingered. But it takes a decision by the president's own cabinet that the president is incapable of functioning. And if your concern is about mental instability, it really is unimaginable that a cabinet will revolt, so that nobody seriously believes the 25th Amendment is going to be invoked with Donald Trump. I realize we don't have a specific chapter on impeachment per se, because it's not that the impeachment clause itself is a fault line of the kind we really focus on, like the Senate, etc. Rather, the real problem, frankly, is that the impeachment clause has been captured by lawyers, so that it now functions, and maybe this is a fault line, maybe in the third edition we would emphasize this more, as to whether the president should be impeachable for, quote, maladministration, unquote. Madison opposed that. He said that would give Congress too much power. So instead, they substituted high crime and misdemeanor. What that means, frankly, instead of giving Congress too much power, it gives lawyers too much power. And so what happens, and we see this today, we saw this in 1998. We saw this for people who are old enough to remember during the Nixon years. It turns into a shouting match among lawyers as to what counts as a high crime misdemeanor. And today, whether or not obstruction of justice, assuming we know exactly what that means, is a high crime misdemeanor. And that's the wrong conversation. The right conversation is, do you trust the president to make decisions about matters of life and death, peace and war? If the answer is no, you should bounce the president. If the answer is yes, then what's the harm in keeping him or her around until the next election?
The story that we tell, in which we discuss at most length the 25th Amendment and what to do about a president who is considered incompetent, at least by some people, on some grounds, the story we tell is in the chapter on presidential succession, and we begin with Ronald Reagan being nearly assassinated. Mm. And, of course, we also refer to President Kennedy actually being assassinated, but the possibility that had the bullet that struck President Kennedy been off in a slightly different direction, then he might have been comatose but alive, or actually, who knows, rehabilitated to some extent. And there are these iffy matters. There are politically iffy matters, and there are physically iffy matters, where knowing what to do about even a semi-competent president, let alone a dangerous one, we just don't know how to handle.
Yeah.
The remarkable fact about Hinckley's attempted assassination of Ronald Reagan is how quickly Reagan recovered, so that it never really generated a national conversation about the 25th Amendment.
I'm reminded of Woodrow Wilson as well, who probably...
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Yes. Edith really stepped up.
Yep. Wilson, our first female president.
Yes.
In fact, that's
exactly right. Wilson should have resigned. Like many presidents, there was a touch of egomania in him. And frankly, one of the problems of the modern presidency. So if we ever had the Constitutional Convention that I continue to want and Cynthia continues to oppose, I would hope we would have a very long conversation about whether we're still well served by the presidential system. But when you think about it, you do have to be a megalomaniac of sorts to put yourself under the pressures of what it takes to run for the presidency, let alone to conduct the office.
Sandy just mentioned the presidential system, and I think one thing that young people assume about our system is that there is one president for 4 years who can be reelected one time, and then that's it. One of the things we do in each chapter in the book is go back and describe the discussions and debates and arguments that the framers had at the Constitutional Convention in 1787. They really did not start out knowing or agreeing that there should be one president. There was talk about having possibly three simultaneous presidents. There was talk about having a president for life, except for maybe, you know, if he, and it was going to be he, behaved badly, although there was not much discussion about what that might mean. So they had very basic, fundamental, structural conversations about how we should be led. And then once they decided, okay, we'll have one president, then they had to figure out what his duties were going to be and how those were going to be shared with Congress or not, and how that person was going to be elected. To the extent that students today know about the Constitution, and then there are problems with the decrease in study and time allotted for civics and early American history, to the extent that they do know about the Constitution, one of the problems, with the exception, I think, of the program you mentioned, We the People, and also many, many conscientious teachers in this country, many young people and possibly adults assume that the system we have is the system we've always had and we're always meant to have.
I would add two quick things. One is that there was discussion in 1787 of the presidential veto power, which has turned out to be very, very important and basically makes us a tricameral and not merely a bicameral system. And if the Senate presents problems, then the presidential veto presents problems of its own, because quite literally one person can render irrelevant decisions that get through the gauntlet of both the House and the Senate. We see this right now with regard to very important foreign policy matters, where bipartisan majorities of both the House and Senate have tried to limit American policy, particularly in the Yemeni civil war or with regard to Saudi Arabia, and Donald Trump has simply vetoed them. But I want to say one other thing about what makes our book different, because it's not that there are no books directed at teenagers, though, you know, our book is among the most recent, and we would like to think both distinctive and better than most of the others. But what is certainly distinctive about our book is that we focus by and large on structures rather than on rights. You will find, I think it's fair to say, that most books on the Constitution for both kids and adults written since World War II tend to focus on rights, the Bill of Rights, the 14th Amendment, or whatever. Those are very interesting, very important, et cetera, et cetera. But it's also really, really important to understand the implications of the structures. And it's an unfortunate truth that the structures are often treated as dull and boring, and they're not.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today I'm speaking with author Cynthia Levinson and her husband, Sanford Levinson, a professor at the University of Texas Law School. Together, they've written a book for young people about the Constitution, and they don't pull any punches. And now let's finish our discussion with Cynthia and Sanford Levinson, all about their new book, Fault Lines in the Constitution, The Framers, Their Fights, and the Flaws That Affect Us Today. Before the break, Sandy and I were talking about the fact that the structural part of the Constitution is something that many students find rather dull. But we agree, it's anything but. Typically, constitutional law classes are taught, if they're taught over an entire year, it's maybe 3 credits in the fall and 3 credits in the spring, and the fall semester is typically structure and function, and then the spring is typically individual rights. And I'm sorry to say that during the fall, when I'm talking about these issues, you're talking about the Senate, the Electoral College, gerrymandering, etc., half the class is just staring out the window because it sounds like too much history to them. Every year, I will get some students complaining, I didn't sign up for a history class, to which I simply shake my head and explain repeatedly that you cannot understand the Constitution without the context. But then January rolls around and we start talking about individual rights. We get to talk about same-sex marriage and abortion and free speech and gun control and all these other things. And then their interest is piqued. That is so unfortunate. I tell them, gosh, that other stuff is important too, guys.
I would say it's even worse than you're describing, because it speaks very, very well for you that you bring to your students' attention such things as the Electoral College or bicameralism or whatever. In most law school courses that I'm familiar with at, you know, our country's leading law schools, what lawyers mean by structural issues really don't involve the Electoral College or the Senate or the presidential veto, because we are so completely fixated on what the Supreme Court decides. And as a matter of fact, I believe that in many ways, the most important parts about the Constitution are the parts that are never litigated, such as the Electoral College or equal voting rights in the Senate. And they're just not brought to students' attention. And the fact is that if they are brought to students' attention, particularly if they're combined with some of the stories that Cynthia wrote out, it is altogether likely that students would get as quickly into shouting arguments with one another about the presidential veto or about the fact that the Senate historically was the graveyard of anti-lynching legislation, for example, which was supported by the Republican president, Warren Harding, who turns out to be more of a hero of mine than he is usually accorded.
He's never accorded hero status, so this is groundbreaking, groundbreaking.
Not even there is he considered a hero.
Well, in all seriousness, there are two important things that Harding did that are altogether relevant to our book. One is that he in fact supported anti-lynching legislation that had been introduced by a Republican representative from St. Louis and that passed the House of Representatives. It died in the Senate because of the power of racist Southern Democrats, purely and simply. The other time that we mentioned Warren Harding in the book has to do with emergency powers and the fact that Eugene Debs, the most important socialist leader in our history, he ran for president several times. He got nearly 1 million votes. He was a major political figure who was sent to jail during World War I because he opposed World War I. He said that basically it was just another example of the ruling class getting into a war that the working class had to fight.
And that had been outlawed to criticize the draft. And even though in the particular speech he made only oblique references to the draft, he was nonetheless convicted, sent to prison.
Sent to prison for 10 years. Wilson adamantly refused to consider commuting his sentence. Warren Harding not only commuted his sentence, but invited him to the White House to meet him. And in all seriousness, you know, Harding was not one of our greats, but it's more than the stop clock principle, because at least on these two occasions, Harding showed real imagination. And in the case of anti-lynching, he was blocked by the U.S. Senate and the inordinate power that white Southern Democrats had in the U.S. Senate.
You know, we've alluded several times to stories that we tell in the book. I would say it's with a mixture of some pride that we did it, but also, of course, some depression, some anguish, that the first story, the story that we opened the book with, does have to do with a lynching. In fact, as it happens, I'm wearing a T-shirt that we got in Montgomery when we went a couple of weeks ago to the museum, the National Museum. It says on the back of the T-shirt.
The National Memorial for Peace and Justice.
Right, which is sometimes shorthanded to the Lynching Museum, which is a very sobering and stunning sight, and I urge every American to go.
That's been long in the works. It's on my list of places to go.
Yes, Brian Stevenson.
But yeah, we talked to him some time ago about his efforts to get more balance in the Confederate, or I should say Civil War era monuments of that city.
Exactly.
So huge issue. Tell me that opening story. I know it's depressing and upsetting, but it's an important story. So what lynching story did you open with?
We tell a story about a man named Richard Puckett, who in 1913 in South Carolina was accused of, quote, accosting a white woman as she drove a buggy down a country road. Puckett denied the charge, whatever it means to accost somebody, and the woman herself did not identify him as the accoster. Nevertheless, he was nabbed and he was jailed, and very early the next morning, a mob of a couple of thousand white men hauled him out of the jail and lynched him. He was, at that point, one of 51 black Americans known to have been lynched that year. We have a graphic, which actually we got from the National Memorial, saying that between 1877 and, believe it or not, 1950, which is not very long ago, well over 4,000 black people were murdered by hanging, and 99% of those who did the hanging went free. One of the reasons they did is that we do not have, as Sandy said, anti-lynching legislation in this country. The current Congress actually has introduced a piece of legislation, as has been done in the past, to outlaw lynching, but it has not gotten any place. If it did get to the Senate, it would probably just sit there forever, as has happened in the past, because of the problem of bicameralism, and in part because of what we were saying earlier about the inequities in the Senate. So as Sandy said, there was a Republican congressman from St. Louis, Missouri, who was outraged by the number of, he was outraged by the number of his black constituents who were lynched. And he was the first one to try to introduce anti-lynching legislation. It has gone nowhere, even though as far back as 1937, 72% of Americans in a poll said that they would support anti-lynching legislation, and even 57% of Southerners, where most, though not all, lynchings have taken place, concurred with that.
The legislation did go somewhere. That is, it did pass the House three times, and it went to the Senate to die. The Senate earlier this decade actually formally apologized to the presumably African-American community or to the country at large for, this was actually in 2005, for never passing the legislation. Interestingly enough, even in 2005, the vote was only 80-20.
And what was especially poignant about that, the resolution did pass. What was especially poignant is that the niece of the man with whom we opened the story, her name is Winona Puckett, was present in the chamber when that passed. But still, the legislation does not exist.
That's remarkable. So you think there still is a current need for anti-lynching legislation?
You know, probably not in the most practical sense of the term, but, you know, as a symbolic measure. First of all, it is really horrendous that it never passed when it might have been useful. And it still says something today that it's on the statute books. Just we have a full chapter on the Equal Rights Amendment. It's a chapter on how very difficult it is to amend the Constitution. And Phyllis Schlafly is the key figure of that chapter because she, more than any other single person, is responsible for the fact that there is no ERA. Well, as I'm sure you know, there are very interesting arguments among lawyers as to whether the ERA really would make much of a difference one way or the other in terms of American constitutional law. But there is no argument, I think, about the fact that it says something about our overall legal culture, that we don't have this simple patch of text in the Constitution saying that rights shall not be denied on grounds of sex. You know, it's the same with lynching, that it says something about our culture, that it still appears to be politically difficult.
I see your point, and we've done a lot of stuff about women's suffrage and about the Equal Rights Amendment. And again, if people are interested, they can go to our podcast site. They can go to the search bar, look up suffrage, look up Equal Rights Amendment, and we'll have lots of stuff for you. In the few minutes that remain, and there are only a few minutes that remain, let's return to something that you alluded to before. One way to fix this, all of these things in one fell swoop, is to call a new constitutional convention. And I know for years now, Sandy has not been afraid of that, but you just mentioned that Cynthia doesn't like it. Cynthia, why don't you like the idea of a constitutional convention?
Well, there are several reasons. As Sandy knows, I would be concerned about the possibility of a runaway convention, although he doesn't think that would really happen. Once you open up the Constitution, you have no idea what might either be introduced and become a part of it or what might disappear from it. But my greater concern really is that there is no indication about how a constitutional convention would be, as it were, constituted. We don't know how people would be chosen, how many people would be chosen, what the role of the states would be, what power the people would have who would go to the constitutional convention, how they would organize themselves. So there are so many logistical and, along with that, political jockeying issues that even before it got started, I'm afraid that it could just blow up. And then if it did get started, the bad feelings and the rancor might carry over into the convention itself.
Okay, Sandy, that was Cynthia's point. What's your counterpoint?
Well, she made two arguments, and she's right that I don't think that the problem with the so-called runaway convention is really significant. I think there are all sorts of political controls on that, because we could, if we wanted to, talk about the formal power of a runaway Congress, that Congress could declare war tomorrow. The Constitution doesn't forbid them from declaring idiotic wars. What we do is to rely on ordinary politics to keep them within line. And I'm actually quite confident that that would take place with a convention. On the other hand, I think that Cynthia is absolutely right, unfortunately, with regard to the problems that would arise before the convention ever met on day one. Article 5 is dreadfully written. It provides no clue with regard to the issues that Cynthia suggests. Given that neither of us likes the Senate and equal voting power of Vermont and Texas, it follows immediately that we would be horrified if a new convention were organized the way the Philadelphia Convention was organized, so that Delaware had the same voting power as Virginia.
Madison, yeah, and that's the only precedent we have. So you might end up with a convention that would never give up any state power.
The framers got away with that in 1787, first of all, because it was thought absolutely necessary, in fact, to have a new constitution. And you had George Washington to lend his particular kind of charismatic legitimacy. Today, to put it mildly, there are no George Washingtons or Alexander Hamiltons or James Madisons in the wings. And if we didn't have some way of resolving the issues that Cynthia brings up, it could turn into a nightmare.
We might not have George Washington, but we do have Morgan Freeman.
Well,
now he could show up and just calm everybody down and send us in the right direction, right?
Well, yeah, but don't forget that, unfortunately, he himself has also been accused of sexual harassment. So it's getting harder and harder to find people who can survive the tests we supply today. Washington obviously was a slaveholder, and I believe in New Orleans there are no public schools named after George Washington because no schools in New Orleans could be named after slaveholders. So, you know,
so even our greatest national icon was a flawed figure. Well, this has been a fascinating, fascinating discussion. I'm sorry that we're running out of time. We didn't have a chance to talk about even half of the issues that you bring up in the book, but that's just another reason for people to go out and buy a bunch of copies. So, Cynthia, once again, what's the title of the book?
The book is called Fault Lines in the Constitution, The Framers, Their Fights, and the Flaws That Affect Us Today. And we appreciate anyone, of course, buying the book and talking about it. But in addition, we would like everyone to know that we blog updates to the book every month at www.faultlinesintheconstitution.com. So everyone is welcome to join the conversation.
Well, thank you both, Cynthia and Sandy Levinson, for an enlightening discussion.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Cynthia and Sanford Levinson, who have written a new book for young people. And that's important. I'm always gratified when young people tell me they listen to this show, and I'm very happy to pass this book along. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. Check them out on Spotify. I'm Stuart Harris. And before I go, let me remind you that we are all over the internet. Just Google three words, Your Weekly Constitutional. You'll come up with our podcast site. There's a search bar. We've got, my goodness, close to 400 episodes now. You can listen to all of them if you want to straight through, or you can search for your particular topic of interest. We have a Facebook page, we have a Twitter account, we got everything. So go online and enjoy yourself. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment, even if you are just a young whippersnapper.